This is the second podcast that we're going to do on trust. We'll call it Trust 2, because it's such an important element in today's leadership capacity that we want to make sure that we cover the full range of issues related to trust. Now, while there certainly will be a broader discussion of the context of trust in this second podcast on trust, I want to remind all of our leadership listeners that trust is a very broad issue, and as we mentioned in podcast number one, understanding the nature of trust and the capacities of trust and all the things that influence trust is really an important leadership capacity. And I would encourage listeners to make sure that they deepen their study of trust and look at all of the other research and information available on just what the conditions for trust are, what trust behaviors look like, what the data shows about what kinds of circumstances influence trust, and develop a personal approach to the whole notion of trust and building environments and relationships and workplaces that represent and demonstrate trust as a part of their leadership capacity. I think the first thing to keep in mind is that the trust is a very human experience and related very much to the human condition. What we're going to try to do is use the foundations laid by Roderick Kramer in the June issue of the Harvard Business Review in 2009, kind of as a framework for the legitimate and strategic effort of incorporating trust behaviors and trust conditions and circumstances into the expression of leadership. A lot of researchers, including he as a social psychologist, have grappled with the issue of trust and explored its strengths and its weakness. Now, in the face of the most recent and massive example of mistrust in our economy, it kind of serves as a wake-up call with regard to really coming to understand trust, with all of the scandals and all of the challenges with regard to ethics and effective human behavior and all of the things that readily represent trust. Demonstrated at the highest level of ineffectiveness and ethical questioning. It's important for us to kind of look at trust with a broader frame of reference and confront our natural predisposition to trust, which is essentially a good thing when relationships are positive and people are trustworthy. The challenge, of course, is when those circumstances aren't present and when we need to confront organizations where trust is something that, instead of being natural and available and apparent, needs to be sought, and we need to distinguish trustworthiness from that set of circumstances where trust is not present. Kramer suggests that to survive, certainly as leadership individuals, this individual must learn to trust wisely, to trust carefully, and to trust well. In other words, their trust has to be tempered by insight and wisdom, caution and care, with the ability to look at trust as not just a feeling or a sentiment or a reflection of relationship, but to look at it as a fundamentally strategic and organizational and relational aspect of very good leadership. First, a little understanding of how trust works in the brain. We're born physically premature, but also highly dependent on parents and caretakers to develop us and our relationships with the world in a meaningful way. In these earliest stages of our childhood, we learn to make social connections and we learn to look into the face and eyes of others and learn to understand the nature of our dependence and relationship on those who care for us in a meaningful and in an appropriate way. As an infant, we learn very early, almost intuitively, the elements of trustness based on the character and kind of response and reactions of our parents and our loved ones in a way that alerts us in the earliest stages of our development to the trust and openness and relatedness of our immediate universe. As social creatures, we are essentially born to engage and be engaged. And this engagement and engagement is largely a subset of the character and kind of trusting relationships we establish at the earliest stages of our lives. The nurturing qualities of life, that parent-child bond, the bond of adults, and the cooperation and interaction and relatedness of that bond is perhaps the central critical attribute that drives brain development and really accounts for our species success and our individual success as human beings. This leads to a tendency, when done well, to see trust as the normative characteristics of social existence and to incorporate a sense of trust in our engagement of life, and building on that sense of trust helps construct the strength and capacities necessary to confront the challenges and the vagaries of life. There is certainly a great deal of science with regard to the physiology of trust and its relationship to oxytocin. Oxytocin creates an opportunity in the brain for trustworthiness and relatedness between people to be positive, meaningful, and to bring a sense of peace and even to reduce anxiety. Importantly also is the understanding of Kelter and others that physical touch and physical relationship has a strong connection to the experience of trust. People who receive immediate and sensitive and unobtrusive touch usually are more likely to cooperate with and to work with rather than to compete against partners and other players in their life. Keltner notes that greeting rituals throughout the world all involve some level of touching, and as a result represent, if you will, the overall and overt sense of trust that we want to establish between individuals. Still, at the same time, we've got to recognize that this tendency towards trust, this overt and psychodynamic as well as biological predisposition to be trusting, can put us in a position to trust others where the cues and alertness necessary to the elements of mistrust may be in some way covered or inadvertently unobserved by the leader and by others in those circumstances where the cues of mistrust could guide us to different decisions and to alert us in ways that might better affect our leadership and our relationship with others. This tendency to what Kramer calls presumptive trust, to capture the idea that we approach many situations without any suspicion at all or with high levels of trust, is something that as a leader we want to examine critically, and we want to be able to address and embed into our leadership capacity as a way of determining whether the conditions and circumstances, the elements and evidence of trust are in place in such a way that we can depend on them, build on them, and move in ways that emulate and exemplify the positive power and outcomes of trust. But again, as a leader, it is important to recognize these as strategic processes, not just simply predisposing characteristics that operate at the genetic and psychodynamic level in all human beings. One of the first elements or rules of trust, and Kramer mentioned seven of them, is the self-knowledge that one has about one's own characteristics and tendencies with regard to trust. It is certainly human to trust, but this tendency to trust skews individual judgment, and this proclivity tends to result in us looking to see what it is we want to see and viewing the world from those particular vantage points and with eyes that validate what it is we want to see. Psychologists often call this confirmation bias. We clearly pay more attention to it because it validates our own values and ideas and notions of what we think should be. And what happens to it is that we give this confirmation bias a weight that is not necessarily legitimate or balanced. And what it happens to do for us is that we tend to seek out and to find and to validate and support the evidence which continues to support a hypothesis about the world, about our relationships, about our values and beliefs, and in many ways downplaying or discounting discrepancies or even evidence that might suggest that those beliefs, those social predispositions, and our own positions with regard to issues and relationships and interactions may be wrong, and that the evidence may be actually contrary to our belief. So we kind of shut down that objective availability frame of reference in our heads with regard to contrary evidence or conflicting evidence or that evidence which does not confirm our pre-existing bias. When the signs of untrustworthiness are present and conflict with our pre-existing biases about individuals or beliefs or knowledge or understanding, we tend to diminish it and sometimes ignore it and certainly don't confirm it or even at least question it because it does not support our confirmation bias in any way. This for individuals can be compromising, but for the leader is very dangerous. The leader must constantly be aware of the fact that knowledge is a dynamic, not a thing. It's not static or stable or, for that matter, permanent. And that much of what the leader does in terms of his or her own capacity is represented in the relationship they have with knowledge and with themselves. The good leader is constantly open to new information, new resources, new understanding. And in that sense of openness is available to new data that relates to what is currently known and relates to what one believes. The biggest challenge that each of us have as individuals is that availability to that information that may run counter to our beliefs. We hold very strongly to our beliefs, and we see them as a part of our value structure, and in many ways, cases, and in many ways for many people, a part of our reason for being and our reason for doing what it is that we do. However, the open, available, and truly balanced leader also recognizes that belief and knowledge and understanding is a journey, not an event, and if it closes doors rather than opens the door to that journey, to that availability, to that openness or discovery that fundamental beliefs should call us to, then the closure of that door, the shutting down of options and of availability, closes our readiness to the journey, our readiness to the openness of learning, and to the availability necessary to demonstrate learning and engagement and embracing that information, that data, the new research and understanding that in many ways may move us beyond our current position, challenge some of our pre-existing understanding, and raise hackles with regard to our confirmation bias issues. So the real struggle for the leader is a self-struggle. A look at oneself in a way that begins to raise questions about positions and beliefs and constant roles and ideas about who one is as a leader and the role that one plays and the kinds of representation that would generate to those who are led. This sense of availability to new information, to challenges to one's belief, to engaging the question rather than the answer, is perhaps one of the most important and distinct struggles one must be willing to undertake and questions that one must be willing to explore. Without knowing what kinds of cues hook into your bias and your pre-existing beliefs, without being able to engage them in an open and honest way, without availability to new information, new understanding, new knowledge, new research, and engaging that in a meaningful way. The leader sets her or himself up for confirmation bias and for a high potential for challenges to trust and to all that's necessary to be able to engage the trust circumstance and condition in a realistic, meaningful, and open way. The second element of building trust is being cautious and starting small, as Kramer suggests. One of the things that you want to do is that you want to build the conditions and circumstances of trust. You want to do it cautiously, but openly and freely, in a way that builds trust with those things that are most at first safe, and then moving to higher levels of risk with regard to issues of trust and trust processes. This starting small with your trust experience becomes really critical, starting with those things that represent perhaps the safest choices that you can make, represent the least risk issues with regard to those with whom you work. By starting small and building small elements of trust and conditions and circumstances, or a context for trust, the leader begins to create the circumstances where the trajectory or the continuum of trust can be built as successes at the smaller levels of trust are generated in the organization. Being able to trust people with equipment or supplies, being able to trust people with small judgments with regard to clinical procedures or processes, being able to trust people with small doses of information and seeing how they manage that information. Using this notion of building trust small helps you as a leader develop others in handling the more safe issues of trust and building the skills in them around handling trust such that as they become competent with safer levels of trust, with less risk-based trust issues, you can begin to grow the trust trajectory by expanding the level of risk and issues in relationship to the elements of trust. One of the things that we know is that there is in many individuals, if not all of us, a illusion of personal invulnerability that in some way influences our trust and demonstrates that we believe that we will not experience some of the misfortunes and some of the vagaries that come out of our human experience. This is just as true with the issue of trust. And so in order to make sure that that bias doesn't generate negative risk-based outcomes, we want to build slowly with regard to those safer issues of trust so that we can generate two things. Number one, an understanding of the current and existing level of trust and people's capacity to actually deal with trust, exemplify trust, and manage their own trust experiences. And then number two, begin a slow process of building that trust so that you can expand it over time in creating a trusting context, trusting conditions and circumstances that allow others, as well as yourself, to build a broader, more global trusting environment that can deal with higher levels of risk and more important ethical issues related to trust. Building that process and constructing it carefully is one of the first stages of building a strategically trusting context and environment that evidences all of the elements necessary to sustain trust and to build in more risk over time. A real rule three that I would certainly add to what we've talked about is the rule of checks and balances. In this rule of checks and balances, essentially what you're doing is you're trying to balance your development of trust with options. Kramer would suggest those as articulated plans for disengagement. I would simply say that in building checks and balances, you don't diminish trust or eliminate it, but you create conditions that help offset the risk that might be embedded in trust. So that if you're sharing information with another that's critical, you would validate and test that information with a colleague not necessarily within your group, so that you offset the information that you're sharing with others and the accuracy and veracity of that information by having shared it with a colleague who can be holder of that information, can validate your particular position with that information. It's the same with every kinds of events. If you have assignments or contracts or agreements, or if you have positions, or if you have a relatively risk-based interaction or decision or strategy or innovation that that can in some way generate the opportunity for others to demonstrate mistrust by compromising it or stealing it or claiming it or diminishing it, that by offsetting it through either written documentation, having shared with others, having submitted what you're sharing with others to another forum, or having notes or information that would reflect your thinking and ownership of what has or is going to transpire, just offsets or creates the conditions for being able to address and to adjust to what risk elements might be embedded in sharing with others the activities or information or dynamics that may in some way evidence or generate that risk in them. In this way, through these checks and balances, you are countering the weight of the potential for a mistrusting outcome or for someone else to act unethically with the information that would suggest your position, your notion, your ownership, your investment in whatever process might be at risk with regard to this interaction. This careful and cautious check and balances is not really cutting the corners off of trust. It's really building a firm foundation against which you can measure the trust of a particular event, circumstances, communication, or relationship. And in doing that, you begin to start thinking about trust as a strategic imperative, not just as a relational event. Again, as we want to mention, trust is a relational event. Trust does exemplify the character of that relationship. But as a leader, you are constantly operating within the leadership capacity. And wearing that hat, you are seeing trust as a condition and circumstances related to that leadership, rather than just simply as a relational element. And also as a leadership strategy in building a trusting, competent, and ethical organization, cautiously, carefully, slowly, and progressively, so that through the iterations of these stages of building trust, through the checks and balances you put in place, you're creating the conditions that ground trust in reality instead of mythology, ground trust in actuality instead of just relatedness. And building that as a leader, you begin to slowly construct the context for a trusting organization, which is critical to sustaining trust in the organization. The fourth rule is that you've got to make trust essentially a condition of the relationship and of the context of the organization by making it an agenda. Trust should be something that is a part of the conversation, a part of the interaction and the dynamic of the organization. You know, we mostly, each of us, mistakenly believe that trustworthiness and our own trust is obvious to others. What we want to do is we want to give trust a language. We want to language trust in a way that reflects what we are committed to with regard to the elements of trust, the conditions and circumstances of trust. We want to put trust on the table, essentially. And we want to put the conditions and characteristics of trust, the ethical interactions and dialogue related to trust, on that table in a way that reflects it as a value of the organization. Not only as a reflection of the leader's personal commitment and personal skill set and personal value system, we also want to translate that from the perspective of the leader and from the requirements or requisites of the organization as an operating reality, as an operating expectation, as a relational rule in terms of the interaction between all of the players in the system. By giving it a language, by making it an expectation, by exemplifying it not only in one's own behavior, but one's language and the language of expectations, and translating that into behaviors, patterns of practice, ways of doing business, issues of communication, content of relationship, so that people begin to see that trusting behaviors, trusting values and circumstances is a fundamental part of the role and work expectation of leadership and the players in place, so that trust itself becomes a condition of membership in the community of work, becomes a function and a set of circumstances, indeed a role of all of the players, that is a part of what's measured, a part of what's dialogued, a part of what's evaluated, so that in all of those processes people can see that ethical and relational and trusting interactions is the way you do business, the way you relate, the way you undertake the actions and activities of the workplace, and the way in which you will relate with each other as a common part of your discourse, of your interaction, of your problem solving, and of your support of each other. In doing that, what the leader does is create the conditions and circumstances that exemplify trust as a part of the dynamic of established work behavior, of determined and specifically articulated relational expectations, and the product of good performance, good relationships, good interactions in the workplace, something to be expected, something to be seen, something to be dialogued and evaluated, and more importantly, something to be demonstrated. Attendance to Rule 5, I think, begins to address the issue of Rule 7, where we really recognize others' struggle with this notion of value and of trust. You know, we've got as leaders to recommend that people come to us with all kinds of experiences and different relationships with regard to their own development, their own place in the world, their own experiences with others, their own openness and availability, and essentially their own relationship to trust. And so a part of what we do in our assessment of those with whom we work and those we lead is to try to develop an idea of others' dilemmas or struggles or frustrations with regard to their own experiences of trust. It would be ideal if we didn't have broken experiences in our life where some of them led to compromises of trust and relatedness and challenges to being available and open to others and to being fully trusting, because some of our experiences, and sometimes significant experiences, have led us to not being trusting and being sensitive and aware to people's interests, attitudes, intents, and relationships. As a leader, there's going to be a wide variety of individuals with whom you work and relate and communicate with who are going to have had relatively broad, sometimes negative experiences with regard to trust. A part of your role as a leader is to be able to understand the wide vagaries of understanding, capacity, insight, and relationship to one's own trusting relationship. Again, building that expectations on interview or on accepting people into your community of work includes notions of the value of trust in the workplace. But it will also include the leader being sensitive to and available to and willing to work with a broad array of approaches to trust, a broad frame of comfort with regard to trust, and being able to work personally with individuals who may have certain greater challenges with regard to their trust circumstances or conditions. Here again, working within the set of expectations that trust is a part of the way our community works means that you're coming to the individuals who are members of your work community from that perspective, with the expectation that in that community, in that set of circumstances, trusting behaviors, ethical and open interactions with each other is the normative practice that we're seeking to achieve here. Helping people get to that place where they see that as normative, where that is validated by others' behaviors, where their own challenges with regard to trust and their own past experiences don't limit their availability to engage, to confront their own struggles and personal challenges with regard to their history in light of trust and non-trust experiences. All of these will be a part of the developmental, relational, and interactional capacity of the leader with regard to those whom he or she leads and with whom they work, and is also a fundamental developmental expectation for the leader. This will often challenge the leader, especially if you've worked really, really hard to develop the conditions for trust in your organization. A new individual comes in with certain negative trust experiences, and you're beginning at ground zero to help get them within the context of the expectations of your organization and help them in many ways deal with some of the broken issues that have rendered them a little risk-averse with regard to trust. Now, it isn't the role of the leader to be a therapist. It isn't the role of the leader to undertake personal psychodynamic and emotional or behavioral counseling with regard to individuals. If issues of trust with regard to individuals really do involve such intense considerations of availability, openness, and the willingness to engage in a trusting environment, then perhaps the recommendation or suggestion that additional kind of work be done with others who are experienced in helping individuals deal with some of their closure, some of their psychodynamic or behavioral issues that represent a significant enough brokenness with trust that it impedes their ability to relate effectively and positively and viably in a work organization. Clearly, that's within the capacity of the leader to suggest. But also, most of us are not broken to that degree of severity and can work through, given signs and evidence of the presence of the willingness and of the engagement of trust as a part of building the relational and interactional characteristics of the work community. And having done that and being willing to engage individuals in their own personal struggles and challenges for trust, the leader actually advances their sense of trust and builds a stronger trusting organization by so doing. Rule 6 merely suggests, and I'm going to spend just a minute on it, that you not only look at individuals, but you also look at roles in the organization with regard to trust. You know, there are roles that people have a right to trust certain kinds of things from and to be able to obtain those things from those roles. If they don't, then they become suspicious as to whether the individual has the capacity or willingness to fulfill the obligation of the role upon which people have based trust for certain kinds of outcomes, values, or work activities. So, as a leader, understanding the role capacity and the trusts associated with those capacities is as critical as anything else and needs to be a part of the antenna, if you will, or predictive tool set of the leader just to make sure that roles are performing as they should. Please keep in mind how significant this is when we think about those of us who have put our investment aside, looking for our retirement and planning for it, only to have the trust for that completely broken by those on Wall Street who we depended to make ethical, trusting, value-based decisions instead of selfish, unilateral, unknowing, and sometimes terribly unethical and illegal decisions. That's how important it is to make sure that roles are fulfilling their obligation. Finally, the rule number 7 with regard to Kramer's particular approach, and one which I support, is that it's really a part of the role of the leader to maintain constant vigilance within and around the organizational relationships that he or she sees in the setting. You know, this external awareness, this ability to have your antenna up when you begin to see things that don't seem right or don't feel right or don't seem to fit as they should. You know, when you have your trust abused, often that reflects that your due diligence, if you will, to use Kramer's terms, wasn't really done at the right time and in the right place. If the leader recognizes that he or she has a critical obligation to be predictive and adaptive, that means that they're constantly scanning their own environment. They're scanning the internal and external circumstances which influence what people do and how they relate and the values that are expressed. When the leader begins to see incongruence in these early stages, trust that incongruence, if it's present in its early stages and left unaddressed, will become more significant in its later stages. Begin to see early signs of mistrust are actually the indicators, if left unaddressed, of serious breaches of promise and of commitment and of trust in the organization. Being able to identify early challenges or early compromises or early indicators of some challenge with regard to trust is really a critical capacity of the leader, because you want to be able to translate that into addressing issues and taking the risks early to address early challenges, so that you're not waiting for a time to address risks when the opportunity to really correct them or change them or limit or adjust them is diminished because of the intensity of those risks. It's really important for the leader to keep his or her eyes open, to be vigilant, to always ask questions, to be looking for clarity, to sort through the mythology, to sort through the symptoms, the sign, the indicative, and out of that begin to see patterns and trajectories and conditions and circumstances that may indicate the growing presence of the conditions of mistrust or the circumstances that can lead to mistrust. Being able to, with courage and confidence, confront them early, to cut them off at the knees or to engage them at a time when they can be dealt with reasonably and can be sorted through with vitality and a preventive notion and a sense of commitment to making sure that the beacon, if you will, of the organization remains bright, and that the work community remains centered and committed to the circumstances and issues which might compromise or threaten their integrity, their values, their ethics, or their viability. This becomes a leadership capacity and demands that the leader give these concerns, these critical early signs and symptoms, a language, gives it a direction, gives it a format for addressing it and for resolving it as early as possible, and for alerting the organization to the possibility of challenges as the organization attempts to seek ways to stay balanced and centered and focused and to maintain its vital value of trust. I think what's important about what we've talked about here, although brief, is to help the leader stay alerted to the realities associated with seeing trust as a strategic and a leadership capacity, incorporating that as much into the expression and learning of the role as almost any other capacity that you might have. Trust is evidence of what you've created in the organization, and it's not created by accident. It's created by intentional leadership, and through the intention of addressing the conditions and circumstances which influence trust, which build it, which create the capacity in members of the work community to develop and respect, understand, and apply their own behaviors that represent and verify and exemplify trust, becomes a really important element of creating a work environment within which people stay centered and valued and positive and engaged. And doing this simple work with regard to focusing on trust, alertness and awareness with regard to the conditions, circumstances, and the leader's role in a trusting organization is kind of a cornerstone in making sure that that environment is one that everybody in the work community wants to be a part of and wants to fully embrace and engage.